Good morning, everybody. Hey, welcome to Faith Community Church. It's great to be with you. If we have never met before, if this is one of your very first times at Faith Community Church, a special welcome to you. My name is Tim. I'm one of the pastors here, and it's great to host you this morning. Good morning, everyone joining us online. We miss you and hope that you are doing well. We are beginning a brand new teaching series together this morning called Unentitled, and the theme is laying down our rights and freedoms for the sake of others in love. And we're continuing in a journey through the letter of 1 Corinthians in the New Testament. So, especially for those who might be here for the first time or haven't been here in a while, just a few things to know about what we're going to read together today. 1 Corinthians is a letter that was written by a man named Paul to a church that he established in the ancient Greek city of Corinth. And archaeologists have uncovered 26 different religious sites in the city of Corinth, and there are probably more that we haven't found yet. Corinth was host to temples to just about every god and goddess in the Greco-Roman pantheon that you can imagine. It also hosted a number of Eastern mystical religions, and they had many lords as well. So Caesar, you know, was calling himself Lord and was worshipped as a god in Corinth, just like he was everywhere else around the empire. And Corinthians prized the external, just like Americans do. They prized outward beauty and status and power. And what happened out here, or what things looked like out here, really made a difference to them, just like it does for us. Now, they especially prized something called knowledge, or the Greek word is gnosis. It's where we get the English word knowledge. They loved spiritual knowledge and philosophizing about esoteric subjects and thinking about the meaning of life and so on. So it was a very religious city, and a lot of their social life together revolved around the temples to all these gods and goddesses. And it was into this environment that the Apostle Paul comes proclaiming that Jesus is Lord, that a peasant Jew who is shamefully executed by Rome has been raised from the dead. He rules over all things. He's the Son of the only true God, and he's Lord. You can read all about it in Acts chapter 18 if you want some time this week. And it's an incredible thought, but Acts chapter 18 says that many, not just a few, but many Corinthians heard of Jesus and believed. And God established a pretty big church in one of the wildest, wickedest cities of the ancient world. And they had problems. Big shocker. Does anyone else have problems? Just don't raise your hand. But 1 Corinthians, then, is sometimes called the letter of love. It contains some of the most beautiful teaching on the subject of love that we have anywhere in history. And that's because the Corinthian church was a deeply divided church. If you're used to building your whole life on what things look like on the outside and comparing yourself and competing with others and status and power and all that, your relationships are going to have some problems, okay? And they did. So Paul writes this letter, I would say primarily, or at least a mega theme, is to say the answer to your problems, first, you know, Corinthian church, is love. That not the kind of self-fulfilling, self-gratifying love that they worshipped in the temple of Aphrodite or that we worship here in America, but a self-sacrificing love that lays itself down for the good of others. So let's find 1 Corinthians chapter 8 together this morning. If you want to borrow a Bible from under the chairs in front of you, we'll be on page 956. And I want to show you something right away, so let me know when you get there, okay? Say I'm there. Oh, you're not that. That was too fast. Okay. Well, in our English translations of the Bibles, you know, they've helpfully put these subtitles in so you can find your way around easier. And you can see there, our editors have added the title, Food Offered to Idols. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking to yourself, oh boy, I am so glad I came to church today. I'm so glad I invited a friend to church today. How relevant to our lives here in the 21st century. Just simmer down. Okay, here are a few more things that you need to know, all right? Most of the meat sold in the marketplaces in Corinth and other Greco-Roman cities came from sacrificial animals offered on all these altars all around the city. And that raised a lot of questions for Christians. Like, did these rituals, did dedicating this food to Apollo taint it? And if I eat it, am I tainted by it? If I buy it, am I not essentially funding paganism? What if I'm at a friend's house or I'm at a wedding and food is put in front of me that I know has been offered to a pagan deity? Which is worse, to run out and insult my host or to potentially dishonor my king, Jesus? Let's pretend that you're a shipbuilder in Corinth, okay? Is there a difference, for example, between going, let's say, so you go to the local, you know, shipbuilding guild, because that's a thing. You go, is there a difference between going to one of their meetings where you know the food has been dedicated to Neptune, but that happened, you know, off stage, nobody even really saw it? Is there a difference between that kind of a meeting and a meeting where you know you're going to be expected to stand in honor of Neptune while libations are poured out in his name? Where do Christians draw the lines? What is okay and what is not okay? See, life in Corinth is complicated. And of course, all of this matters because our world is looking more and more like Corinth all the time. We live in a time where we're seeing a growing cultural and ethnic diversity all around our nation. It would have been really uncommon 50 years ago for a family in the St. Croix Valley to have a meaningful relationship with a family of another faith. Now that would be pretty normal. I would expect that most of us probably have that. And as the church's cultural influence continues to wane in our nation on the one hand, and then at the same time, we see Jesus calling people to himself who have almost no background now with the Lord, no background with the scriptures, no background with the church. How are we going to love one another? How are we going to love people that are just meeting Jesus for the first time when they bring all of these taboos and misunderstandings about grace and freedom and love? How are we going to love each other when we discover that we have all kinds of taboos and misunderstandings about grace and love? I don't know if you had an experience like this, but I remember when I, you know, going to college and meeting all these Christian people, and they really were followers of Jesus. Like, I knew them well enough to be like, no, I know this person is solid. And then I would see them do something that I was like, wait a minute, you can do that? Is that okay? Because I had no experience with that. And more in our context, because, you know, what God is doing around us, all of us are going to run into questions that we have never had to ask before. And, you know, as a nation, I don't think I need to make this case for you. You know, as a nation, we're becoming more tribalized and more fragmented. Unfortunately, the church is following suit. And Christians are withdrawing from one another over things that honestly should not matter that much. But they do. Because life in Corinth is complicated. How do we have real relationships with people that we think are just wrong? How do we stay salty in the world without being compromised? And that's what this series is about. So, 1 Corinthians 8, are you ready? Thank you. Thank you for being ready. Are you ready?
Yes.
Thank you, for goodness sake. This is going to be a high audience participation morning, okay? Now, chapter 8, verse 1. Now concerning food offered to idols. We know, and then there's some quotation marks there. Okay, he's quoting from a letter that they wrote to him. So this is the Corinthians. This is what they were saying. All of us possess knowledge, gnosis. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he's known by God. Therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence and that there is no God but one. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, As indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. However, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. But take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus, sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it's weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I'll never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. In the chapter that we just read together, Paul does not tell us yet where to draw the lines. We're going to get to that throughout this series. But what he does do in chapter 8 is articulate for us the principle that has to come first in all of these questions. The principle is that freedom and knowledge are not the pinnacle of the Christian life. Love is. Freedom and the freedom and knowledge to do what we feel, that we're called to do is not the pinnacle of Christianity. Loving one another in a self-sacrificial way is the pinnacle of Christian morality. He says in verse 1, we know all of us possess knowledge. Good for you. See, in their minds, being spiritual meant having knowledge. But he says, knowledge alone, knowledge that puts us at the center of our lives, makes us a jerk. It makes us puffed up, but love builds up. He says in verse 2, if anyone thinks they know something, they don't know. If you think you're super smart, then you don't get it. What does he mean by that? That real Christian knowledge cannot be separated from love. The litmus test is not how much do you know. It's how much does what you know humble you, make you a person of love, a person of awe of God? How much is your love growing? He says, if anyone loves God, okay, if your love is growing, it's because God knows you. That is the evidence that God is actually doing something real in you. I'll just say this real quick. We can teach, I mean this, we can teach anyone to study the Bible. Did you know that? You don't need to be a Christian. We can teach anyone to make sense out of the Bible over the age of 10. But there is a world of difference between knowing how to study the Bible and when God actually starts speaking to somebody, when God actually knows someone. So I'm meeting with a guy. He's been reading the Bible for 6 months, first time reading the Bible. He's been a Christian for 6 months. Incredibly smart guy. He lives in Minneapolis, and his lease is coming due, and all of his roommates and all of his friends are leaving the city because of the trouble there. And he is asking me, do you think that I should stay? Because this seems like the kind of place Jesus would want his people. I didn't teach him that. That wasn't on our discipleship syllabus. Who's teaching him that? God is talking to him. Then he's asking me, instead of driving out into Hudson to go to church like he's been doing, is there a church plant right in the heart of all this stuff that you would recommend to me that I could be plugged in with them? I'm not teaching him that. God is doing something there. 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 5, Paul writing to this young pastor, he says, the aim of our ministry is love. All this preaching, all this teaching, all this singing, everything, unless we're a people that are growing together in love, it's not real. We're wasting your time and your money. That's a mega theme of the letter. Now, the situation, what's happening here in Corinth, is that there are people who are saying no Christian should ever eat any kind of food that's been dedicated to one of these pagan gods. It's just a wicked thing. And it's these Christians who keep going to these parties that give Jesus a bad name. And then others are saying, oh, come on. You're so superstitious. You're so prudish. It's people like you who give Jesus a bad name. And they were passing judgment on each other and withdrawing from each other. But in addition to that, okay, because virtually all the food in Corinth passed through the temple before it made it to the marketplace, that meant that virtually all civic meetings, all public meetings, all social events, think of every wedding, funeral, you know, club meeting, trade meeting that you ever go to, they're being served this food. And so not only do you have Christians withdrawing from each other, but you have Christians that are just withdrawing from the world completely and separating themselves so that they're not able to function as the church is called to in the world anymore. And there are two parties in the passage, okay? We're going to call them the strong and the weak. Okay, so look at verses 4 through 6. This is how Paul describes the strong. And notice, he counts himself among the strong. Okay, he says, therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know, that is, we strong people know, an idol has no real existence. They're just stone or wood. We know that. And there's no God but one. Sure, there's many so-called gods in the heavens. There are many lords, many people out there claiming to be Lord. But there's only one God and one Lord. And the strong know that these so-called gods have no objective reality to them. So they're right in their theology. There is no Athena. There's no Apollo. There's no Zeus. These are just wood or stone or figments of people's imagination. They have nothing to do with the real world. Eating food that has been sacrificed to a block of wood is not detrimental to us. As long as you're not also worshiping the block of wood, okay? Now, there are a few caveats that he'll cover in chapter 10, but we'll get there. But the strong are right. Okay, the strong are people who are not plagued by a lot of superstitions. They don't deal with needless fears. They're not legalistic or moralistic people. They don't wrestle a lot with a sense of guilt by association. You know, if I'm seen with X, Y, or Z kind of people, you know, I'm going to be tainted by that. If I shop at X, Y, or Z, you know, place, I'm tacitly endorsing their politics. If I associate with a certain group, you know, I'm going to be tainted by that. For the strong, not everything has to be black and white. It doesn't have to be up or down, right or wrong. They're comfortable with gray. In a healthy, strong person, the sense of God's love and his grace and their security as children of God is such that it gives tremendous freedom, and they're not unnerved by that freedom. So when they contemplate, you know, going someplace where they know crazy, weird stuff is going to be happening, they have this confidence in their hearts, like, God is with me. I'm walking in the Spirit. I know his voice. And when I encounter some gray issue where I don't know what to do, he'll talk to me. God will keep me from stumbling. And they just enjoy a level of freedom to operate all over different kinds of places. The strong know that walking into a temple, going to a certain party, eating food that was offered to a block of stone, these things in themselves do not pollute us. That is actually pagan nonsense. Jesus said that it is not what goes into us that defiles us. It is not things out there that defile us. What did Jesus say? What defiles us comes from where? From in here. He gives us a list: evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, drunkenness, slander, lying, lust, and so on. All those things defile us, and they come from here, not out there. You show up with those. We should want, okay, every Christian, you should want to be strong because it comes with tremendous freedom to be who we're called to be. But he says in verse 7, not everybody knows this. Not all Christians possess the knowledge that we just discussed, but some, he says, through their former association with idols, they still eat this food as though it really were offered to a god. So I think that most people, even in 21st century America, still tend to think about what's out here as the things that are most real. There are Christians, okay, in Corinth who grew up, you know, worshiping these blocks of wood as though it really were Athena or something. And now they've come to Jesus, and you just can't throw that off like a switch. So they see this food offered to an idol. This is a real thing for them. And they should not be eating it. When we think about a weak conscience today, we usually think about someone who does bad things, but there's no remorse. You know, their conscience just doesn't work. Paul is actually saying almost the opposite. In this context, a weak conscience, it means that their understanding of the gospel isn't developed enough yet to protect them from feeling defiled by things that actually aren't wrong. A weak conscience is too weak to protect us from feeling condemned or being afraid of things that aren't real. Does that make sense? Now, these people, they love God and they want to please God. They just have not had time to think all this stuff through. So the weak tend to be more fearful of things they should not be afraid of. They tend to be more easily offended. They're more easily confused. And they're sometimes quicker to break fellowship with people over stuff that doesn't matter. Now, this is for a variety of reasons, because of the way we're raised, because of things we've experienced or been taught. But the weak do not like gray. They do not like open-ended questions. They want to know, is it right? Is it wrong? Is it in? Is it out? Is it up or is it down? It's not that they don't believe in the grace of God. It's just that there's not that full sense of its adequacy for them to kind of rest in. So as they think about going to places where it's not going to be black and white, and the rules are not going to be clear, they don't have this confidence that God is with me, he's going to speak to me, he's going to keep me from stumbling. They don't have that confidence. And it's just easier to stick to rules, right? I mean, how many of you have raised some kids, okay? Nobody else? They're in the room, okay? Do you or do you not give kids rules? Please, well, like I would hope so, okay? Why do kids need rules? Because they're not smart yet, right? So is crossing a, not you kids, you're super smart, but so is crossing a street a good thing? Everybody say yes, please. Yes, it's a really good thing. Do you want your 21-year-old being like, Dad, I don't know. No. Is it good for a 2-year-old to cross the street? No. That is a bad idea because they are not smart enough to, they're not wise enough, right? They haven't had enough life experience to be doing that. And that's what's, they're weak. Kids are weak. That's what's going on here. We've got people who've said yes to Jesus and it's real and God is at work in their lives, but they don't know. Like, where can I cross and like what do I do? That's what's going on. So before you spend a lot of time trying to figure out which bucket you're in, strong or weak, I'm just going to tell you, based on how you grew up, what you were taught and all that, you're going to be stronger in some areas than other people, and you're going to be weaker in other areas than other people, okay? So we're all kind of a mixed bag. In our context, so the question is not, am I strong or weak, but it's where am I strong and weak, okay? So in our context, okay, good old US of A, 21st century, what is food sacrificed to idols? Okay, well, there's three criteria. Okay, ready? Number one, it needs to be a widely accepted cultural practice. That, number two, is not inherently right or wrong. Okay, I can't take you to chapter and verse where it says, thus and such is forbidden to Christians, okay? So widely accepted cultural practice, it's not inherently right or wrong, but it is associated with things that are right or wrong. And it could actually trip a Christian up pretty badly, okay? Here are some examples. This is from a book called Conscience by Andy Nasselli. I would highly recommend it to you if you're ever wrestling with this. Here's just a short list from his book. Watching R-rated movies. How much time and money do I spend on sports and hobbies? What kinds of music should we sing in corporate worship? How low can the lights be before it's a concert? Celebrating Halloween. Modest attire. How modest is modest? Is Sunday a special day or is it not? Watching violent sports for entertainment. Using certain reproductive technologies or other forms of genetic engineering. Eating meat. Eating fast food. Playing video games. Reading Harry Potter. Wearing makeup. Following certain child-rearing practices. Homeopathic medicine versus vaccines. Public school, homeschool, private school, or other. Body piercing, tattoos, smoking cigars, drinking alcohol, going into debt, what kind of debt, when should couples have children, how many children should they have, yoga, and lying to children about Santa Claus. That was only 25 things. That was only 25 things. There are about 50 more. Why do I share this list with you? Number one, to help you understand, there are no two Christians in the world who agree on those 25 things. So we should all hold our convictions with just a little humility, okay? So you want to grow your hair long or something? I don't, oh my word, he's possessed by the devil. I don't need to go there like right away, okay? I can step back and say, maybe it's how I was raised that, you know what I mean? So that's number one. Number two is that some of the things on this list really are not a big deal to you. So you may see this list and you hear drinking alcohol in moderation. You think, why is this a big deal? But you are sitting down the row from people whose entire families have been destroyed by alcohol. And they just cannot fathom how a person with the Spirit of Jesus would ever mess with that stuff. Why would you even touch that? Why would you bring it into your home? We may roll our eyes at things like tattoos, right? Or long hair, or just, you know, I'm just picking on people. But there are places in the world that God may call you where tattoos, for example, are always associated with either slavery or the occult. Some years ago, a former student of mine moved to South Korea to teach English. And she found a wonderful church there, a gospel-preaching, Jesus-loving church. And they loved her so well, and she was growing so much. But when she went to join the church as a member, she discovered she would have to renounce the practice of yoga. And she was completely flabbergasted by that. Because that was such an important part of her life. It was part of how she took care of her body. It's just, for her, it's just stretching. So here's an example of a widely accepted cultural practice that isn't inherently evil or not evil. Okay, she's not trying to connect with the all soul or you know, chanting mantras. She's just doing the downward dog or whatever it is, okay? Just taking care of her body. But in Korea, where yoga is born in that context, there is religious devotion attached to that. And you've got God calling people out of this demonic practice into Jesus. And they're just learning to follow him. And then they see church members practicing the thing they've just renounced. And it just totally throws them for a loop. Like, how can this even be? Is Jesus Lord? I just don't even know. And so the church just had to put an all-out ban on it and say, in this congregation, this is off limits for the sake of our weaker brothers and sisters. And churches have the right to do that, okay? Did you know that there are pastors that we love and respect who believe that not drinking wine in communion is a sin because that's what Jesus did. But we're, you know, this is Minnesconsin, the home of binge drinking. And when we as a church have just decided it's just not wise. It's just not wise for us. We're going to do grape juice. It all comes from the same plant. It's the same color. It's fine. That's how we're going to do it together because we love each other. This is the thing that weaker brothers and sisters have a really hard time with. If you'd look at verse 8 with me, food will not commend us to God. Food will not commend us to God. Now, if you're a Corinthian, you've spent your whole life connecting food to your worship. You can't just throw a switch. And it takes time for the full reality. Think about, just jot in the margin of your Bible, just write Acts 10. Go read it sometime later today. That's a story about Peter being told by Jesus to eat non-kosher food. He'd never touched this stuff in his life. And Jesus is saying, I really need you to get over this because I need you to preach the gospel to this Gentile named Cornelius. Get over it now. And Peter's like totally thrown for a loop. So it takes time for the full reality of what God has done in Jesus and who we are and the freedoms that we've been given to really sink in. It takes study. Okay, it takes worship, reflection, community. And it takes time. But some Corinthians who are strong are coming along and saying, oh, you are so superstitious. There is no Athena. There's no Apollo. You know, it's just a tattoo. It's just yoga. It's just a ham sandwich. Get over it. And I am not going to change for you. In fact, and the weak brother says, ugh, I don't want to, they know more than me. They've been a Christian longer than me. They know more than me. They know their Bible. I don't want to be a fuddy-duddy. So I guess I'll do it too. But they haven't actually taken the time to think it through. That isn't their conviction. Remember, a weak conscience is a conscience that's not able to protect you from condemnation. So you have the weaker brother saying, I don't want to look like an idiot. You know, I guess I'll do this. So they eat, and then they go home. And they're just overwhelmed by a sense of failure and condemnation. Or, worse yet, you lead them into a situation where you can handle the temptation, but they cannot. And you turn them back over to their old way of living. And they're destroyed by it. Paul says, verse 11, congratulations. By your knowledge, the weak person is destroyed. And the brother for whom Christ died is destroyed. And so in sinning against your brother and in wounding his conscience, you have sinned against the Lord Jesus with your freedom. So he concludes, if food makes my brother stumble, I'll never eat it again. I'm going to be done. Jesus puts it this way in Matthew chapter 18. Jesus says, yes, temptation has to come. Yes, temptation is going to happen. But woe to the one who brings it. He says, it would be better if you tied a giant rock around your neck and threw yourself in the ocean. Don't mess with immature Christians who need time. Don't even mess with those that God is calling to himself. Okay, so you got a lovely Jewish family living down the street that invites you over, you know, for a birthday party. You do not show up with a platter of bacon to say, look at my freedom. I'm so free. No. Even the one that God is calling to himself, don't mess with that. You're free, okay. You put love in the scale and your freedom in the scale. Love and the glory and honor of God are the principles that are to guide our lives. The litmus test for all of our decision making, for the way we think, is, does this actually love my neighbor? And does it bring honor and glory to my King? Now, a quick word then to those areas of our life where we're weak. And everybody's got them, okay, because of the way we grew up and everything like that. To those areas of our life where we're weak, we're not entitled to remain weak. It's not a good thing. A weak conscience that withdraws from people or from unfamiliar situations is a sign of immaturity, not of holiness or godliness. In fact, this need to fearfully evaluate all the time, everyone and everything, actually betrays a lack of confidence in the promises of God and the power of His Spirit. He has promised He will speak to you. He will lead you if you will listen. One commentator puts it this way. He says, by weak in faith, Paul is not referring to a person who does not believe in Jesus, but a person who does not understand the implications of justification by faith alone. Your conscience, okay, just so we're all clear, please give me your attention again, especially if you're a young person. Your conscience should never be disobeyed, even when it's wrong. You should never disobey your conscience because you damage it. Paul says there, if you entice a weaker brother to disobey their conscience, you just wounded them. You've harmed them. Okay, so I'm not asking you ever to disobey your conscience or act against it. Sometimes there is a real danger for you, and you should stay away. There may be things that other Christians really are free to do, and you are not. Okay, if you come out of a history with alcoholism, for example, or even have just an extensive family history of alcoholism, and you just feel like, I just don't think I should be messing with this stuff, you should obey that. Okay, that's not weakness, that's wisdom. And there's kind of a fine line there, but that's how it is. My question is just, well, you know, actually, I got to tell you this real quick. So a dad pulled me aside after first service, a dad who raised like 6 kids and they're all pretty decent, okay? He pulled me aside after first service and he said, in our house, we had this rule. We said, we never ask why not. We ask why. Because his kids were always coming to him saying, hey, I'm going to go to this party and it's going to be a rager and it's going to be super fun. And he would say, help me understand. And they'd say, well, why not? You know, we're free. I don't know if they were actually saying, we're free in Jesus. They read him, you know, 1 Corinthians 8. I doubt that was actually happening. They'd say, why not? Why not? Why not? And he would say, no, 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 no. In our house, we ask why. The litmus is, am I actually loving and building people up, and am I glorifying God? If that's really why you're going to the rager, okay, and maybe I should use a different example, but if that's really what it's about, you know, okay, we're going to talk about that. But the question is always, why? There should be a positive impulse to the Christian life. Not in these gray areas, it's not just like, oh, I'll just try this, I'll just try this, I'll just try this. Because you could stumble into something that actually destroys your life. Okay? But with all that said, is there any place in your life where it seems like godly people that you know, whose faith and lives you really respect, are there places they just seem free to go? Are there people or groups that they just feel they interact with freely that for whatever reason you're just kind of, eh? It would be worth asking yourself, is this because I'm weak? Am I not trusting in the mercy of God, the grace of God, and the Spirit of God to keep me? Food will not commend us to God. Evil comes from within, not from without. Every other religion in the world that I'm aware of, including the religions of the Corinthians, were saying we're justified by what we do. We're made right with God or whoever by the things we do. But Christianity comes along and says it isn't your past, it's Jesus' past. It isn't your performance, it's Jesus' performance. It isn't what's outside of you that makes you right with God. It's His work within you. And you belong to Jesus, or you belong to God because of what Jesus has done. And that makes you incredibly free. It makes you unnervingly free. And it makes you free to ask a whole new set of questions. It doesn't need to be, am I going to get this right or wrong? Is this in or out? Is this black or white? But you can ask, is this best? Is this wise? Young people, does it honor my parents? You know, just things like that. Now, to the strong, we'll close with this. To the strong, Paul says, watch out. Knowledge puffs up. It will make you a jerk if you're not careful. But love builds up. There are two ways people generally deal with people who think differently, live differently, or act differently than they do. One is, the world teaches us to tolerate each other, which means you never make a negative assessment of someone, but you don't have to love them either. You don't have to actually have a relationship with them. You just can't ever say anything bad about what they're doing. Well, Paul comes along and he makes a pretty negative assessment of weak people. He says their theology is wrong. They've got it wrong. But the other way we deal with people who are different than us, etc., especially in the church, is to assimilate them. That is to say, I would love to have a relationship with you as soon as you change and become like me. Okay, as soon as we agree on everything, we can be friends. As soon as we can get at least 12 out of the 25 things on that list, as long as we're on the same, then we can have fellowship with each other. And Paul doesn't do that either. So he says to them, he makes a negative assessment of the weak, and then at the same time he says, but if my eating would cause you to stumble, I'll never do it again. I don't need meat more than I need a relationship with you, more than I want to build you up, more than I want to help you to grow. And that's the model that we're called to. Jesus reached out to us when we were radically different from him. He met us in the midst of our weakness. He called us when we were wrong and made space in his life for us so that we'd have the space to figure out what it looked like to walk with him. And that's how we're called to live for each other. And I think we'll see as the series goes on, for people who are very far from God today. But that's going to take a lot of wisdom, and the gospel is going to have to be so strong in our lives that we're able to walk in the world without fear of being defiled all the time. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for these people. Thank you for your gracious work in them. And I ask today, God, that you would add to that gracious work an increasing sense of freedom. Father, I pray that you would make us people who are patient with one another, who bear with one another, and who receive each other as we are working through all of the different things that we bring into our relationship with you. Father, I would ask in Jesus' name that you'd cause Faith Community Church, because of that, to be a place where we are not afraid to go to places where it is not clear what's right and what's wrong. That our faith in you would increase, our confidence in you would increase. Jesus, as we close, I would ask, would you put it in the hearts of every teenager here this morning, every adult here this morning, of every child here this morning, to set Christ apart as Lord? And would you work in their hearts right now to decide, no matter what, your honor and glory will be absolutely top of mind, and that loving others in your name would be close behind. We ask for this in Jesus' name. And everyone said,